Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Right to work, 75 years ago this week. And guess who's celebrating? Intel in Ohio. Not so fast, I'll explain. And today on the show, it's our segment called Working Class Perspectives. We'll talk about the new social compact and Tom Conway, president of the United Steelworkers. Welcome to the Friday, June 24th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Joe McCartan is going to be our first guest today. Joe is an expert on U.S. labor, social, and political history. He has taught at Georgetown University since 1999. In fact, he is the founding executive director of Georgetown's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, which she has led since 2009. This organization is a leading labor research, education, training, and innovation center that draws on Georgetown's distinctive identity, including its Catholic and Jesuit traditions and prominence as an arena of policy debate in the nation's capital. And I'll tell you, we've been doing this segment at least a dozen years. And again, John Russo and his wife, Sherry Lincoln, who used to run the Center for Working Class Studies out of Youngstown University, are now involved in the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. And Joe is one of the many bloggers on the website, workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. And the article that he's going to talk about is titled The Pandemic Worker Wave and a New Social Compact. Turns out that earlier this month, June 2nd and 3rd, the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor convened a major public virtual gathering entitled The Pandemic Worker Wave and a New Social Compact. The conference invited participants, dozens of them, talking about workers' rights and the power of social compacts. And the timing could not be better. Joe points out working people are voting with their feet and refusing to return to or accept the sorts of low wage, no security jobs that have become the norm over the last 40 years. Record number of workers quit their jobs last year. They call that the Great Resignation. So consequently, we are in the middle of what's being described working class ferment. How about that? Working class ferment. Working people are increasingly engaging in collective action, such as organizing and striking. Why? Well, they want better wages, improve working conditions, increase agency on the job. And you know this. Public approval of unions is at a 50-year high, especially among young people. So we're going to talk about what's happening in America and where it's possibly going. What kinds of social compacts do we need in order to secure worker prosperity in a pandemic-altered world? I've said so many times on this show, the pandemic has changed everything. Everything. So that's exactly what we're going to talk about. Then we're going to check in with Tom Conway, president of the United Steelworkers, one of the many sponsors of America's Workforce. So Tom has been president now for 3 years. He took over after Leo Girard retired in 2019, comes to us from New Jersey. His father was a very active member in the International Union of Operating Engineers. His mother worked in a brush factory where she successfully organized a union and negotiated labor contracts. With a background like that, with parents like that, you know what kind of guy he is. And we're going to talk about inflation, the economy, the steel workers, and we're going to play a little clip later in the show. This is, I mean, this is so emotional. As you know by now, if you've been listening to the show, paying attention to organized labor, the AFL-CIO had their convention last week in Philadelphia, during which time Liz Shuler was elected to president of the AFL-CIO. She was the interim president since Rich Trumka died last August. And then Fred Redmond, who comes to us from the steelworkers, started with the steelworkers in 1973, became the number two person in the AFL-CIO, vice president, secretary, treasurer. Very moving moment for Tom. And we're going to play a clip when he, at the convention, introduced Fred and talk about Fred and his role in American labor. Fred is the highest ranking black American labor leader ever. Certainly good news. We'll talk about the convention. We'll talk about organizing. And we got some good news. How about this? The United Steelworkers announced last week that players in the United States Football League voted in favor of joining the steelworkers. The USW, in coordination with the United Football Players Association, filed a petition for a representation election on behalf of about 360 USFL players after a majority of them signed cards in early May. Good news. Good news for the football players. Good news for the steelworkers, no doubt about that. So Tom Conway, international president of the steelworkers, and we're talking, what, 850,000 members. If you were listening to yesterday's show, you probably paid attention to Scott Paul, who is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And if you missed that, awpodcast.com, that's our revamp website. But one of the things that Scott was talking about was the Competes Act and the CHIPS Act. And we've been on this subject for months now. And the conversation came up about Intel and the plants that they're building in America, one in Ohio. Well, guess what? Guess what? Intel is delaying its planned ceremonial groundbreaking for their plant just outside Columbus. Why? Because of our Congress. That's right. Governor Mike DeWine was informed of the decision after he got a phone call from the CEO of Intel, Pat Gelsinger, this week, citing, quote, uncertainty over federal legislation that would provide funding to reshore microchip manufacturing in the United States. Now, that groundbreaking was scheduled for July 22nd. The move, according to a report today in the Plain Dealer, is not a signal that Intel is delaying or canceling construction of the plant. We're talking a $20 billion plant, which would expand and become a $100 billion facility. Rather, it's reported, it's a sign of frustration and pressure aimed at Congress and their inability to come to a consensus on federal legislation. And here's some more detail on this. Congress has moved at what's being referred to a glacial pace in funding the CHIPS Act, with lawmakers haggling over the price tag. It's $52 billion in incentives that are currently part of the larger American Competes Act, pushed by Democrats. Republicans have balked at the idea of supporting the broader innovation package, which has a price tag of around $300 billion. Sounds like a lot of money, right? When it comes to federal government, $300 billion, I'm sorry. I mean, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was over $1 trillion, which is definitely going to help America. So hopefully, and you know Intel's pretty smart at playing this game, they're going to hold Congress pretty much hostage right here. But the bottom line is, we have a chance to build in America, create American jobs, if our Congress would get its act together. So we'll keep you posted on that one. I'm sure Dorsey Hager, who will feature on the show next week from the Columbus Central Ohio Building Trades, is scratching his head because they're scrambling trying to get workers ready. We're talking 700,000 construction workers for that project. Well, yesterday was the 75th anniversary of what's being described as landmark legislation that allowed states in America to pass right-to-work laws. And because of that legislation, we're going back to, 1947. Because of that legislation, 27 states now allow all workers to choose not to join or pay fees to a union. They could belong to the union and not pay the fees to belong to the union, which I just can't figure out. I mean, if I want to go to a golf course, get a membership there, I can't play golf unless I pay the fees, right? Well, guess who's celebrating? I take you to the halls of Congress right now, and you have to listen to this representative. And I've talked about her on the show many, many times. Her name is Virginia Fox. She's a hardcore Republican, and she heads the House Education and Labor Committee. And she hates unions. Oh, my God, does she hate unions. Listen to what she said on the House floor this week.
Madam Speaker, the what I'm about to say will surely cause a strong case of hypertension among my Democrat colleagues and their union allies. I won't hold back. Unions didn't build the middle class in America. Entrepreneurs and hardworking Americans did. Tomorrow marks the 75th anniversary of the landmark legislation that enables states to pass right-to-work laws, and it is a cause for celebration. Since 1947, 27 states have decided to allow employees to choose for themselves whether to belong to a union or not. And what a smart decision passing right-to-work laws was, Madam Speaker. They give workers the freedom to make their own choice when it comes to paying union dues. With rising inflation and gas prices, workers should not be forced to hand their hard-earned paychecks over to the unions in order to keep their jobs. Time and again, unions prove that worker representation plays second fiddle to a partisan political agenda that comes as no surprise to anyone.
You know, one of my favorite movies is The Godfather, because in The Godfather, there was one line that I swear I live by. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. My labor friends listening right now, Virginia Fox is your enemy. She does not like unions, as you just heard. And here she goes on the House floor. That was actually from 2 days ago. Yesterday was the anniversary, the 75th anniversary of Right to Work. And she continued with her lies. She said data shows that states with right-to-work laws have lower unemployment and higher job and wage growth than states without such laws. That's a complete lie. They've done a number of studies showing that people that live in states where they have union representation that are not right-to-work states have a higher standard of living. At least when you're in a union, you make about 10-11% more than those working in the same job that are not represented by a union. Manufacturing, listen to this. She says states which have enacted right-to-work laws in the past 22 years have a 20.7% higher manufacturing share than they would have if they did not protect worker freedom. That's another lie. This is all perpetrated by the National Right-to-Work Committee. And it's been going on for a long time. I mean, 75 years. And they're celebrating. And, you know, she's not alone. She's not alone. But she's at the head. Virginia Fox, Republican leader out of North Carolina. Like I said, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. You have to know who is on your side. And this woman is certainly not on your side. All right. I have to take a break. When we come back, Joe McCartan will be joining us talking about the new social compact in America. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans. And we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers. And we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with employment and good employment, I might add. You can find more at ulagency.org. Before we start our segment with Joe McCartan out of the Kalmanovitz Initiative of Labor and the Working Poor, we're just talking about right to work. Yesterday was the 75th anniversary, and Virginia Fox down in North Carolina is celebrating it, along with a number of Republicans. They live in right to work states. They would like to see all of America go right to work. We have to play this little clip, and I've done this several times on the show, the governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice. And this is what he said after his state went right to work. Let's listen.
Well, the bottom line to the whole thing is just really simple. We went out and passed a right-to-work law. We got rid of prevailing wage. We built fields all over the place in thinking that they will come. They didn't come, did they?
Virginia Fox, are you listening? Right-to-work ain't working. All right, let's go to our live line right now and join Professor Joe McCartan. Again, this is our segment we started many, many years ago called Working Class Perspectives. Very insightful writing. Just go to workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. And joining us is Professor Joe McCartan, who authored a book. We've had him on the show talking about this, about when Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, which was a turning point for American labor, no doubt about that. Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Professor McCartan, welcome back to America's Workforce. How are we doing today?
Great, Flash. How are you?
Good, 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 good. We're not celebrating right to work here. I just want to make sure.
Not at all.
No. Right to work for less. That's what we say. That's what many in labor say.
That's the right way, yeah.
There you go. So, I've said this on the show many, many times. The pandemic has changed America. We've got all kind of issues to deal with, supply chain issues, the great resignation. And I want to zero in on that because you talk about worker unrest, tired, low-wage jobs, lack of benefits. They're trying to join a union. We're seeing it happen all over. And if they're in a union, they don't like the contracts that are coming out. So, they're going on strike. So you put it all together. This is this just like the air traffic controllers of 41 years ago. This could be beneficial for for unions. What's your take on what's going on in America?
Well, I think that's the right way to think about it, Flash. I think that, you know, I'm a historian, as you noted, and, you know, I look at labor over the long haul, and, you know, there are important turning points that have happened in the history of the movement. One of them, a bad turning point, was 75 years ago when right to work was enacted. Another was 41 years ago, as you noted, when Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controller strike and then opened up kind of open season on unions. A lot of strike breaking followed in the private sector in the 1980s. But I think the current moment is also a turning point, but in a positive direction. And I think you see evidence of this in lots of different ways. I think, as you point out, the Great Resignation that began about a year ago, lots of people leaving the jobs that they have in search of better ones. The wave of organizing that we're seeing at places like Starbucks, and now most recently in a place not far from Washington, D.C., Towson, Maryland, an Apple store voted to unionize. We're seeing an unprecedented rise of enthusiasm among young people for unions. And just as the civil rights movement was really a generational movement, I think what we're starting to see is young people stepping out and helping to inject new energy and life into a union movement that they increasingly see as necessary for their futures. They're looking at a society that's growing increasingly unequal, and in which power and wealth are increasingly concentrated, in which their own opportunities feel increasingly constrained, and they see the union movement more and more as the vehicle to use to fight back against all of that.
You discussed what we're talking about right now at a conference earlier this month, and it was a virtual public gathering titled The Pandemic Worker Wave and a New Social Compact. Maybe you can reflect on that. You had a lot of participants, I know.
We had people from around the country able to participate in this due to the fact that we were doing it online. And I think, you know, as people came together and to discuss where we're at, one of the consensuses that emerged from that is we really need to think big in this moment. That in a lot of ways, we're in a moment of real struggle, and in which the opponents of labor and worker power exercise tremendous influence in the courts, for example. And we're going to be hearing over the next number of days, you know, new decisions by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's done nothing for workers and is likely to make it more difficult. So in the midst of this kind of moment, I think sometimes it's tempting to just become defensive and try to see what we can hold on to against an onslaught by people like this anti-labor court. But the consensus of our gathering was that we need to look beyond all of that to think big about what we need in the 21st century, what kind of social compact we need that will center working people and take their concerns and build our policies around those concerns. And part of this is involved in reviving labor, as we were just talking about, in this wave of organizing. We're seeing lots of evidence of that. A lot of it's got to be about public policy and how, in a broad range of ways, we need new policies that are pro-worker. And, you know, one of the things that we need to look at is the cost of housing and what's happening to that around the country. We talked about that issue and the fact that right now we've seen most recently a record number of private houses, single family dwellings being bought up by speculators, mm-hmm. driving up the prices of housing around the country. We need policies that push back against these trends because they're all making life harder for working class families.
You're talking about social compacts, and you touched on those. Housing is a big one, but there's healthcare, mm-hmm. educate. Look at the cost of education today. I mean, you teach at Georgetown.
How many I'm people in can that. Yeah, yeah. So I can.
How many people can afford that?
It's becoming ridiculous, Flash. And the more that we rely on basically students saddling themselves with debt to be able to get college educations, the more treacherous our future becomes. So many young people, and this is, I think, one reason why you're seeing this wave of organizing among baristas and others these days, is that so many young people come out of, a college education saddled with debt and facing jobs that barely allow them to pay, make their debt payments, let alone ever accumulate money to be able to buy a home of their own down the road. So we've got to address all of those things. And you're right, healthcare, education, housing, these are all working class issues that demand attention.
You know, it's interesting, the conversation we're having today, because I mentioned Reagan and the air traffic controllers. You wrote a book about it. Yesterday, we were talking about the Jack Welch effect. Jack Welch, the late CEO of General Electric, who turned that company around, fired a lot of workers. That happened in the 80s as well, and then went into the 90s. And you saw the entrance of Wall Street, and you mentioned, like, the housing market. You've got hedge funds buying up real estate right now. It seems to me, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that Wall Street has more or less ruined America. It's almost like they ate up the middle class by what they're doing or what they have done in the past probably 30, 40 years. What's your take on that, Professor?
Oh, I think you hit it right on the nose, Flash. I think sometimes we focus too much on a historical figure like Ronald Reagan, whose policies clearly, had a huge impact, and I think a negative one on workers. But I would say that preceding Reagan and after him, the power that was amassed on Wall Street and the way that they used that power has done exactly what you've said. They've made their money at the expense of the American working family. What started to arise on Wall Street in the mid-70s was this notion of maximizing shareholder value. Jack Welch was a product of that world. And what they decided was that what would improve stock prices the most, and therefore CEO compensation the most, was downsizing, outsourcing, squeezing the wages of workers. Wall Street rewarded that behavior. It was behavior that basically cannibalized what was strongest about America, which was a thriving working class in the post-World War II years that was able to fuel economic growth through its consumption. And they started to shift the driving force of our economy to investment indebtedness, and increasingly working class household debt started to grow as wages were being shrunk. Wall Street profited on that debt. Mm-hmm. Wall Street profits on the debt of student loans. Wall Street profits on what's happened to the housing market. It's been a driving force of a lot of what's made working class life harder.
So what's the takeaway? You had this gathering several weeks ago, and I must say this, Professor, one thing Wall Street does not have is boots on the ground. And you mentioned this in your piece, that working people are voting with their feet. They're refusing to return to accept the sorts of low-wage, no-security jobs that have become the norm over the last 40 years. Do you see that continuing, and is that the answer to fighting Wall Street, in your opinion?
In the end, it's got to be people power that takes back this country and that puts people before profits, and that says that we can have a profit-making economy, but not one that comes at the expense of the people. but that serves the people. And so, yeah, clearly that has to happen. Now, one thing I think is interesting about this moment, Flash, is to consider what impact this wave of inflation that we've recently witnessed, what impact that's likely to have. The last time we saw inflation of this kind was in the 1970s.
Right.
And it was in that period, actually, that we started to see a lot of labor agitation in both the public and the private sector. The labor movement was beginning to stir in response to that because, as you noted earlier, some union members these days are not that happy with their contracts because the wage increases that are in those contracts aren't keeping up with some of these spikes in prices. That happened in the 70s, too, and it triggered a kind of a movement of restiveness both inside and outside the labor movement that was starting to head, I think, in a very promising direction toward challenging some of what was beginning to happen on Wall Street then. But then came Reagan's election, and it was a huge setback. I am looking today at what impact rising prices are likely to have on workers. And if workers can understand that their only true refuge is collective action, collective power, banding together to challenge some of these trends. What we're seeing right now at the gas pumps is a product not just of the war in Ukraine and, you know, supply chain problems coming out of, the pandemic and its after effects. It's also the fruit of decades of increasing monopolization. And we've seen that in the oil industry and in other parts of our economy, where a very few actors have way too much control over our economic fate, that they profiteer at our expense. And we basically let the tool of antitrust, which was one of the key things that came out of the New Deal era of the 30s, we've let that atrophy.
Right.
And we're going to have to revive that.
There's a lot to unwind here, no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right, Professor, we're going to leave it on that note. Very insightful. I love having you on the show. Let's do this again, especially with this inflation situation. We'll see what happens in the months ahead. Joe McCartan, expert on U.S. labor, social, and political history, also a founding executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. Check out workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. You take care, stay safe, and we'll talk to you down the road, okay, sir?
You too, Flash. Take care.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Tom Conway, president of the United Steelworkers, coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Hello from the Communication Workers of America, District 4. We are a labor union representing a vast array of workers in different industries, including the Association of Flight Attendants, Telecommunications, CWA Passenger Services, Public Health Care, and Education Workers, the IUE, CWA Industrial Division, the National Association of Broadcast Employees, the CWA News Guild, not to mention our growing digital sector, and many others. If you're interested in organizing your work group or learning more about what it means to be CWA strong, visit our website at www.cwad4.org. That's CWAD4.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis. And please give us a rating. Five-star ratings are always appreciated. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers, oh.aft.org. We had Melissa Cropper on the show a couple of days ago. If you missed it, check out our revamped website, awfpodcast.com. We got all the shows posted there, awfpodcast.com. All right, let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania right now, which is the home, the headquarters of the United Steelworkers. And joining us on line number two right now is the president of the Steelworkers. He's been president for 3 years now, and that would be Mr. Tom Conway. Tom, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today, my brother?
Doing good. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, and I'll tell you, it was very emotional for me to see the introduction to Fred Redmond. This is all posted on the Steelworkers website, by the way, sharing our Fred Redmond with the world. Fred's been a frequent guest on the show. We started this segment about 8-9 months ago called The First Friday with Fred, and it's the first Friday of each month, so next Friday we'll have him on. But I want to take you to the floor of the AFL-CIO convention right now. This was about a week ago in Philadelphia, and here's Tom Conway nominating, Mr. Fred Redmond as Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. Let's listen.
My name is Tom Conway. I'm the president of the Steelworkers Union. I'm surrounded by our family today, and we're all so proud to make this nomination of our brother, Fred Redmond. This is an amazing story of a man who can trace his ancestry back on both sides, his paternal and maternal families, to slavery, and who can move up through the years, and whose family moves to Chicago, and his dad works jobs sweeping floors and pumping gas and building a future for his family, and his mom travels on 3 buses a day to clean homes for other people. And during that time, they raise their family together. And as a young teenager, Fred and his siblings and his cousins travel back to Mississippi to work on the sharecropper farm that his grandparents work on other people's property, and literally pick the field and pick cotton so their grandparents can survive and thrive. And Fred learns work and the value of work and the value of family and the value of labor as he's a young person.
You get the idea of what Tom is talking about, and you can access that entire clip by going to the homepage of the Steelworkers, usw.org, sharing our Fred Redmond with the world. Tom, this was a very I just watched it at my computer, and I got all emotional just watching it, and I saw the look on your face. This was one moment for you, and it was a hell of a moment for the United Steelworkers of America, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, Fred has just been so much more than a colleague. I mean, we've come up together through the union, and really just well-deserving of this opportunity. And he's going to be able to do a tremendous amount of work from this platform together with Liz. So, yeah, it was very proud for us. I had all the steelworker delegation with me. Who stood there at the mic, and we made this nomination together. And, you know, we're looking forward to changes in the AFL-CIO. I think this team is set to do a lot of good stuff. I mean, I think they have good, clear understandings of the challenges facing the country's labor movement and the whole way that work is thought of and and how the country seems to have really sort of learned a lot, particularly coming through the pandemic, about who is doing work and who is making the country run and who's just sort of keeping things on the rails every day. And I think we're heading in the right direction in terms of that and how people perceive the value of unions and particularly young people as well. So, yeah, we were thrilled to be able to have Fred get this job.
Yeah, it's really an honor to have him on the show, as well as yourself, because we go to the union leaders, we go to the people that are making those changes, and there was a lot of energy in that convention. We played a lot of clips. Liz Shuler, Stacey Abrams fired up the crowd over there. Liz Shuler made a few comments. I'd like to get your take on it about organizing. She wants to do like this transformational organizing to gain, well, and this is the floor, not the ceiling, as she pointed out, 1 million new members in the next 10 years. What's your take on that? I mean, now's the time. I mean, we're seeing it happen right now.
I think labor has to sort of do a better job, do a good job at explaining to young people. There's a big shift going on in the economy. The baby boom generation is in large part retiring out, and there's a labor shortage that's out there, both due to this, you know, what they call the Great Resignation, but there are fewer labor market participants. And so this is a time for labor to sort of take advantage of that and tell their story and explain to people, yeah, really, there is a value in collective bargaining and in being able to together talk to your employer about your arrangement at work. And there's just, it's been decades of just the policies of trying to crush unionism and drive down people's ability to earn decent living wages. And it's resulted in wage stagnation in our country. And so there is a good chance here to turn it around. And the goal of 1 million people over 10 years is not unrealistic. And I think it's going to take unions working closer together, not sort of in strife or in a competitive spirit with each other as much as may have been some past times, and forming a strategy going forward about how to reach out to people and get them to see the value of this. So
right.
I think she's, you know, on the right track here.
The time is now. Tom Conway joining us on our live line, president of the United Steelworkers, one of the many proud sponsors of America's Workforce, USW.org. We'll continue the conversation right after this.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Let's go back to Pittsburgh right now. Rejoin Tom Conway, president of the United Steelworkers, USW.org. Tom, I see the USFL players just recently voted to join with your union. And this speaks to the diversity of the steelworkers. You think of the steelworkers, yeah, you think of steel, but you also represent those in the healthcare industry. You've got oil, the refineries, especially down south. But how did this one pan out? This is kind of interesting. This is like a startup league, right?
Well, it's a startup league. Look, some time ago, we began working with college athletes who were really treated poorly by the NCAA, and they just needed sort of a big brother, a sponsor, to help them understand how to deal with employment issues, challenge whether or not some of the schools, maybe in a state school you're not an employee, but in private school, you know, that's sort of a different kettle of fish. And then from there, we were contacted by this startup league, the USFL. And, you know, there's going to be up to 400 players, and right now they have 8 teams fielded, and they're playing strictly out of Birmingham. But, you know, these guys playing this game are just workers, and they're earning, you know, they're all having to work other jobs to pay their bills and feed their families and go out there every week on the playing field, and those are tough physical jobs, so... look, there's also a history of these leagues that will struggle. And, you know, sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't. And there's been bankruptcies. And so we have some expertise about those issues with them, and we can work through them with them. And look, we've had a good relationship with the NFL Players Association. And while this is not certainly at that level, this is just a group of people who are trying to get something going. So we're looking forward to a good relationship with this league and do what we can for these players.
Very good. Let's talk about steel. How are we doing with prices? You know, we are in very inflationary times right now. What's your take? What's your take on what's happening?
I think steel is going to benefit from the president's infrastructure bill. And we're going to see that unfold as it takes a while to get the projects going. Prices have moderated some over the last couple of months. They're down in some cases 30%. And so, you know, they ran hot for a while. And some of it had to do with supply chain. Some of it has to do with the tariffs that are in place, which I think are absolutely deserve to be in place. And they've been moderated somewhat where it made sense with countries like the UK and Japan. And they, you know, they now have a quota, which they can ship in. But, you know, by and large, I think the mills are doing good. They're certainly turning a profit, and they're putting a lot of money back into the industry, and some of our major companies are reinvesting and building out operations and putting a lot of repair and maintenance money into the ones that exist. So, look, I think by and large, steel is doing good. We're going to bargain with the steel industry this summer, both at U.S. Steel and the Cleveland Cliffs. And, you know, I look forward to getting through labor agreement without much trouble or much strife. People get rewarded for their efforts, and we'll be on our way. So, you know, hopefully we can solve a few problems and move forward.
Well, I'm hearing good things about Cleveland Cliffs. They're a pretty solid company, so that's certainly good going forward. Let's switch to oil here, because I know many of your members work in refineries, and I'm hearing all kind of different stories. I mean, they're saying, well, the refineries are at max capacity. Then I'm hearing, well, then they're drillers. They're not drilling enough. There's a fight over federal land versus other lands.
The oil industry is a difficult industry, frankly, for anybody to deal with. And we see that right now with inflation. And then anybody who thinks that the oil industry isn't gouging on prices right now is just kidding themselves. And so part of the inflation problem we're facing has to do with oil companies as well as other companies, food companies. A lot of companies see this as an opportunity to really just sort of line their profits and then do a bunch of stock buybacks and almost the worst of what the system can do, particularly at a time of war. So it's frustrating to watch that go on when it's not necessary, when the profits of this industry are almost always good. They had a dry spell for a couple of years. But look, many of them have taken refineries offline over the last couple of years. And there's probably four or five, you know, sizable refineries that were being converted to biofuels, where they render oils from restaurants and other places. And those things are much reduced operations and cost a number of jobs. And then some refineries just closed. And so refining capacity in the U.S. is reduced somewhat. Mm-hmm. But even at that, there's enough refining to go around. This is driven, the energy crisis is also driven in large part by what's going on in the Ukraine with Putin invading that country and the ripple it causes around the entire world. And, you know, now fuels are heading into Europe by necessity, and all of it drives up the price. And so it, you know, it's all sort of falling at one time, one perfect storm. But the idea that this is a time for an industry in one quarter to make $35 billion, which is really so significantly higher than it would normally be expected to make, is kind of a demonstration of why people ought to have a discussion about a windfall tax and that companies can't take advantage of times like this just to overprice a product because they can get away with it. And we see it in rents. We see it in foods. We see it in a lot of places where people can't resist the impulse to take more because they think they can take it.
Yeah, they're all jumping on the bandwagon. I'm seeing some food prices up 40, 50%. I'm like, wait a minute. Where did that come from?
It makes no sense at all. Places like PepsiCo, Tyson, I mean, and people feel that, the everyday need. I mean, people feel this in rents, energy costs, gasoline at the pump, and food. And it's just unnecessary. It's an unfortunate sort of byproduct of our system. And to try and say, well, workers are getting more for wages, you know, a percent more in a labor agreement isn't driving this. These percentages are just crazy. So, we're frustrated with the industry and called on the industry early on not to do this. But they are who they are.
Yeah, you got it. Tom, we're going to leave it on that note. Tom Conway, president of the United Steelworkers, international president, 850,000 members strong. All right, you take care. Stay safe. We appreciate your sponsorship. Stay safe and keep up the fight, my brother. Okay, my friend?
All right. You too. Thank you.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, we're going to check in with the Texas Building Trades and the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.